Court appointed is meant to be for entertainment purposes and basic legal information only.
Nothing in this podcast should be considered as legal representation nor legal advice.
Only use the knowledge presented herein to dazzle your friends or possibly win bar trivia. Perspective on Legal Frivolity. I'm your co-host, Mike Meadows. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurl. And I am just a dude.
It's getting to be that time of season again.
Ho, ho, ho. How you doing, little Michael buddy? Santa wants to know what you want for Christmas.
I've been pretty nice.
Have you?
Well, I want to talk about Santa's brother.
You mean Commerce Clause.
That's right. I want to talk about the Commerce Clause today.
He says, jingle, 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 because it's all about the money. Show me the money, Commerce Clause.
We talked about the Commerce Clause on a previous episode.
Maybe even two.
Yeah, maybe even two. Well, it's pretty pervasive in U.S. legal theory.
Pervasive. It's just like kudzu.
Yes.
It's everywhere.
You can't get rid of it. Although recently, since 1986, it's actually been cut back quite a bit, whereas kudzu since 1986 has been on the spread.
Well, that's true. That's because there's just no reversing it. It's like one of those invasive species.
It is, actually.
Like those jumping fish in the water there in the lakes that have come in that knock you out of the boat, and lionfish and all that kind of stuff.
Or you cruise along with your net and you scoop them out of the air.
Yeah, you can. They'll jump right in your boat.
I've seen the videos of that.
Yeah. Lionfish, have you seen about those?
You mean the ones that in saltwater?
Well, no, they've got these lionfish that have been invading, and they've got those big long, you know, the big long tails above and below. I mean, mm-hmm. They're supposed to be like tropical tank fish, but they're an invasive species. They've gotten in, and I think they're paying people to catch those and get them out of the water. But some guy came on Shark Tank with a plan for what to do to reduce the lionfish problem, and his plan was eat them.
Well, yeah, I mean, they actually are. They publish a lot of recipes on how to eat them.
Yeah.
But I think they are poisonous, so it's a very specific way you have to know what you're doing.
Yeah.
They will sting you, too.
We've got a plan to reduce the population. Oh, what's that? Eat them.
Well, they are. They're very damaging to the environment because they have no natural predators.
Exactly.
So
nobody wants to mess with them lionfish.
Except us.
Yeah. They don't know they're lying.
First time I ever saw a lionfish was in Naked Gun.
Naked Gun?
That's the movie where Leslie Nielsen is speaking to Ricardo Montalban in his office, and he accidentally jabs that fish with a pin.
Oh.
That was actually a lionfish.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
He could have been telling the truth. He didn't have due process.
But the Commerce Clause, the reason I wanted to talk about it again is because there was a case decided recently that turned on the Commerce Clause, and I thought it was pretty interesting, so I figured we'd get back into the classic showdown between state and federal rights again. So, sound good?
Absolutely. Whatever. I mean, it's that time of year, so why not talk about old Commerce and his clause?
Article 1, Section 8, Clause 3 of the Constitution reads...
Jingle, jingle, jingle.
Congress shall have the power to regulate commerce with foreign nations and among the several states and with the Indian tribes. And from that, there is tons and tons of power derived to Congress. Just those simple, however many words there are there.
Well, they made the rules. Of course they'd want to make it so that they have all the power.
The significance of the Commerce Clause can best be described maybe in this Gonzales v. Reich case, which is a 2005 case, Supreme Court case. And it says, the Commerce Clause emerged as the framers' response to the central problem giving rise to the Constitution itself. The absence of any federal commerce power under the Articles of Confederation. For the first century of our history, the primary use of the clause was to preclude the kind of discriminatory state legislation that had once been permissible. Then, in response to rapid industrial development and an increasingly interdependent national economy, Congress ushered in a new era of federal regulation under the commerce power, beginning with the enactment of the Interstate Commerce Act in 1887 and the Sherman Antitrust Act in 1890. The Commerce Clause represents one of the most fundamental powers delegated to Congress by the founders. The outer limits of the Interstate Commerce Clause power have been the subject of long, intense political controversy. Interpretation of the 16 words of the Commerce Clause has helped define the balance of power between federal government and the states, and the balance of power between the two elected branches of the federal government and the judiciary. As such, it directly affects the lives of American citizens. So basically, in order for Congress to pass any kind of law, they have to have some sort of specific power, specific grant of power to do so. Now, absent any kind of actual verbiage that says they have the power to do that, a lot of times they rely on the Commerce Clause, because basically anything that affects interstate commerce, they can regulate.
And that you could probably find an argument to misconstrue pretty much most anything.
Yeah, and for a long time, it was basically used to regulate just about anything. It was kind of like the started to become used as the catch-all to regulate power over the states.
Mm-hmm.
The Chief Justice John Marshall.
Hey, I've heard of him.
The namesake of Marshall University.
We are the sons of Marshall.
Wrote the opinion in Gibbons v. Ogden in 1824 that the power to regulate interstate commerce also included the power to regulate interstate navigation. This was kind of an interesting case, this Gibbons case. Commerce undoubtedly is traffic, but it is something more. It is intercourse.
What? They're regulating sex, too?
A power to regulate navigation is expressly granted, as if that term had been added to the word commerce. The power of Congress does not stop at the jurisdictional lines of several states. It would be a very useless power if it could not pass those lines. So the court's decision in that case basically goes on to say that the federal government has power to regulate commerce among and between the states. It doesn't stop at those lines. So commerce is inexplicably tied to, it's not inexplicably, inescapably.
It's explicably tied.
Inescapably tied to the Commerce Clause.
Well, I guess the commerce of intercourse is actually prostitution.
What?
He said the intercourse of the Commerce Clause.
Oh, okay.
That's prostitution, isn't it, when there's commerce involved in intercourse?
It's the oldest profession.
Besides being a lawyer.
Kind of the same thing, maybe.
Yeah, pretty much.
Marshall went on to say, talked about...
Hire them to screw somebody else instead of yourself.
Marshall went on to say, the wisdom and the discretion of Congress, their identity with the people, and the influence which their constituents possess at elections are, in this, as in many other instances, as that, for example, of declaring war, the sole restraints on which they have relied to secure them from its abuse. They are the restraints on which people must often rely solely in all representative governments. So the Gibbons case was kind of interesting. New York basically wanted to grant a steamboat monopoly to Robert Fulton. He actually franchised his steamboat business to Ogden, and Ogden claimed river traffic was not commerce under the Commerce Clause, and further that Congress could not interfere with New York's grant of exclusive monopoly within its own borders. Basically, what Ogden was trying to say was that New York could control river traffic within New York all the way to the border with New Jersey, and that New Jersey could control river traffic within New Jersey all the way to the border with New York. So Congress basically did not have the power to control anything.
Well, I guess they were saying we'll concede the roads, but when it comes to the river, that's fair game.
Well,
it's like international waters.
Kind of, I guess. Basically, what Ogden was trying to say is they could not invalidate his monopoly because he only transported passengers within New York.
Right.
So he didn't go into New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, the federal government couldn't regulate it. But the Supreme Court said that basically Congress could invalidate the monopoly since it was operational on interstate channel of navigation. In the decision, the court assumed interstate commerce required movement of the subject of regulation across state borders. And some of the different principles, and I'll reiterate them again since you like this one so much. Commerce is intercourse. All its branches, and is regulated by prescribing rules for carrying on that intercourse.
They're carrying on with branches? Never heard of that involved in intercourse.
Commerce among the states cannot stop at the external boundary line of each state, but may be introduced into the interior.
It requires penetration, okay?
Comprehensive as the word among is, it may very properly be restricted to that commerce which concerns more states than one. No joke there?
Is that like a swingers club?
Yeah, I guess so.
Everybody throw your car keys in, and whichever state you get, that's who you're doing business with.
What is it? Fidelio.
It's as bad as the railroad. The railroad has all those suggestive terms, too, you know, like angle cocks and glad hands and rough couplings and things like that. I think
what is the
Founding Fathers did that, too.
What is a glad hand?
A glad hand?
Yeah.
That is
I'm scared to ask.
That's the coupling on an air hose. The air hoses each have a hand, as you will, on each end, so that when you put two railroad cars together, you have to connect the air hose system. And so that's the coupling on the air hoses that goes together. It's called a glad hand.
Hmm.
And that you have to put them together in a certain way, then push them down where they interlock with each other so they'll stay coupled during the trip that they're on.
Coupled.
Yeah.
Now, basically, this kind of view of interstate commerce, and it expanded and expanded and expanded and kept expanding, basically, until the Rehnquist Court, Justice Rehnquist. And basically, during the Rehnquist Court, they kind of started limiting the Commerce Clause again. Whereas before, it was expanding, expanding, expanding. In the 80s, it started shrinking, shrinking, shrinking.
The 1980s or the 1880s?
The 1980s.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I didn't know which century we were here, because we were talking about steamboats just a minute ago.
Oh, we were. But, yeah, steamboats are a classic.
Right, it's hard for me to keep up here with all this intercourse floating around.
So, now the case that really started to shrink the Commerce Clause is the United States v. Lopez. And that was a case where the Supreme Court confronted the conviction of a 12th grade student for carrying a concealed handgun into school in violation of the Gun-Free School Zones Act of 1990, which was enacted by Congress. So basically what Congress did under that act is they made it a federal offense for any individual knowingly to possess a firearm at a place that the individual knows or has reasonable cause to believe is a school zone. And basically what the nexus they were trying to present there is that education was tied to commerce, and therefore it was enacted under the Commerce Clause.
Right.
The Supreme Court basically looked at that and said, you know what? I just don't see it. It was much more verbose than that, but that was essentially what they said. There is no actual...
I'll know it when I see it, and that ain't it.
Yeah, there is no actual connection between interstate commerce and guns in school zones. So while we appreciate what you're trying to do here, and that's probably a very noble cause, we think it's outside the bounds of what the Commerce Clause allows you to do. And if a state wants to regulate that, then certainly they can do that themselves.
Well, if I was arguing for it, I would say, well, see here, Your Honor, here's where we make our stand. If a young man gets shot when he's at school because another young man brought a gun and shot him, then he isn't going to go out and get a job, and therefore it affects our commerce.
Well, the court basically said that education is a traditionally local government activity, which if you think about it, there's local school boards.
Mm-hmm.
And while education undoubtedly has an economic aspect, the nexus between regulating gun violence and the Commerce Clause power to regulate interstate commerce seems particularly strained. So
very strained.
Yeah, very strained. Now, one thing whenever the Supreme Court looks at these different kind of cases is there's different tests they look at. And there's three different kinds of tests, and I want to explain those briefly before we kind of move on and get into what we're going to talk about, the meat of the episode here. But before that, I believe we might have a couple motions or a motion pending before the court.
We have a motion, which is better than no motions.
That's right.
Or the locomotion.
Who do we have on the docket?
We have on the docket today our good friends from Sleep Number. Now, we know how important it is this time of year to think about our sleep, because we all want to get to bed as soon as possible on Christmas Eve for Santa to come.
That's right. In anticipation of Christmas, you want to hit the sack early and get to bed, so when you wake up, Santa will have already come and delivered all the presents.
And nothing will help you get to bed quicker than a Sleep Number 360 for the holidays.
That's right. The new Sleep Number 360 smart bed helps make spirits bright with proven quality sleep.
So many couples disagree on mattress firmness. Sleep Number beds let you choose your ideal firmness on each side, so it's just right for you. Or Santa can decide your firmness.
And the new beds are so smart, they sense your every move and automatically adjust to you, keeping you sleeping comfortably throughout the night, even when you hear rattling coming from the rooftop.
Yes, or a clatter that arose on the lawn that rose to see what's the matter. something along those lines. Anyway, there was more than mice making noise.
That's right.
So, come in and see the newest Sleep Number 360 smart beds. This is not a bed. It's a brighter you for the holidays from $9.99. Ho, ho, ho.
And Sleep Number is the official sleep and wellness partner of the NFL. You'll only find Sleep Number at one of the 575 Sleep Number stores nationwide. Visit sleepnumber.com/court to find the one nearest you.
Learn more about home, wellness, and tech from the leader in hashtag smarter sleep by visiting the Sleep Number blog at blog.sleepnumber.com. Tell them Mike and Tommy sent you to say nighty night.
Now, I said there's different standards of review for Supreme Court cases, and this is kind of the different test that whenever there's some sort of federal law that the Supreme Court looks at, and based upon what kind of law it is and what kind of right the federal government is regulating, there's different standards. Now, for example, the Commerce Clause uses the rational basis test, which is actually the lowest and least stringent level of review. And the rational basis test whether the government's actions are rationally related to a legitimate government interest. So that's the real lowest standard, and it's a pretty easy one to meet.
So is the government interested in intercourse?
Interstate.
Interstate intercourse.
That's right. Commerce.
Interstate commerce intercourse.
And glad-handing.
Panhandling.
So the higher levels of scrutiny are intermediate scrutiny and strict scrutiny. And this different levels are basically whenever there's a suspect or quasi-suspect classification, or if basically a fundamental right is implicated. So if it's something regulating somebody's gender or race or something along those lines, then it's basically going to go to these higher standards. Additionally, if it's a fundamental right, such as, like the right to marry, as in the case of Loving v. Virginia, which was decided that's a fundamental right. One interesting thing that is not a fundamental right, which you might think is the right to drive a car. It's not a fundamental right. It's a privilege.
Well, I would agree with that. So is voting.
Don't know about that.
It's a privilege to be able to vote.
I do consider it a privilege to be able to vote, but I think it is a fundamental right. So how's that for some word phrasing?
It's two things in one.
What was that? Two things. Is that a commercial?
Yeah. Don't you remember that?
No.
Certs. Two mints in one.
I don't remember that.
You don't remember that?
Well, now.
So the two things were, what were they? Some type of, something was casual and something was strict or something?
Intermediate scrutiny and strict scrutiny.
I figured it had to be a dominatrix that would administer the strict scrutiny, wouldn't it? She'd say, boy, you're going to have to really be good on this one. We expect you to be strict here. I'm going to be strict with you. A lot of scrutiny.
Now, the current case I'm talking about that I thought was kind of an interesting decision based on the Commerce Clause is basically a case that came out of the Eastern District of Michigan. And this actually just came out probably about a week or two ago. So it wasn't actually decided by the Supreme Court, but a district court decided using the same kind of standard that they look at. U.S. District Judge Bernard Friedman issued an opinion regarding female genital mutilation or female circumcision. So the background is that in 1996, a law was passed that basically said that any kind of female genital mutilation or female circumcision was a federal crime, and performing that was a federal crime as well. And so the basis for this law was the Commerce Clause. Essentially, the Congress was basically trying to say that, hey, this is tied to interstate commerce, and that therefore we're going to make this a federal crime in order to punish people who do this. Now, before we get into any more about this issue, you know, whether or not it passes muster to be a federal crime or not, I think is kind of not really has much to do with whether or not what you think of the crime itself. I think we can all pretty much agree that it's really bad.
Yeah, well, that's what I was going to say. Yeah, I can understand where they say it shouldn't have been passed under the Commerce Clause. Maybe somebody stretched a bit, but it still needs to be banned completely and not allowed because I mean it's just reprehensible.
It is. But I think the point is that basically, from looking at from a Commerce Clause kind of analysis, does it meet the standard to fit under the Commerce Clause, and should Congress have the power to do this? So that's the instance that I think it's kind of an interesting case and worthwhile to talk about. So a Dr. Jumana Nagarwala of Northville.
Glad you got that one.
Yeah. was arrested and accused of heading a conspiracy that lasted 12 years and involved seven other people and led to mutilating the genitalia of nine girls as part of a religious procedure practiced by some members of Daiwada Bora, which is a Muslim sect from India that has a small community in Metro Detroit. I think I pronounced all those pretty well.
They were perfect. I didn't say them, so they were perfect.
And basically, this doctor was charged under this federal crime. So right now, currently, there's 27 states that have laws that criminalize female genital mutilation, which includes Michigan, which they actually passed that in response to this. And basically, their penalties are generally stiffer than the federal statute, basically punishable up to 15 years in prison, and federal law was only 5. But to go back to the kind of analysis about this case itself, the judge issued a pretty lengthy opinion. It was approximately 28 pages, and goes through some pretty sound analysis. And part of what the judge says is here, and you know whether or not he applied it to this case or not, he goes through the different areas about why this might apply or why the federal government might be able to do this. Now, the first factor the judge looked at was to evaluate the economic nature of the regulated activity. Now, this case did actually have parents transporting children across state lines to have this procedure. So basically, that was kind of the argument that the federal government was trying to say is that basically, hey, this does fit interstate commerce because they're transporting these girls across state lines. The judge, though, however, felt that basically that wasn't sufficient because there were only 9 victims in this case, and that basically having 9 victims wasn't sufficient to show that there was basically interstate commerce from it. Now, I think the two arguments you have for that are is if they were transported across state lines for some sort of medical procedure, some sort of business, I mean, is that sufficient for interstate commerce? And additionally, given the fact that this is kind of a secretive or criminal enterprise, are there more victims out there that we don't know about? And there are actually people who travel from state to state to do this. So I think those are the two sides of the argument there. The judge in this case basically said that didn't really feel like it was sufficient to have the interstate commerce under the first kind of prong there. The federal government basically said that they tried to compare it with the interstate market for marijuana and pornography, but the judge basically said that was unsupported, unconvincing, and didn't feel it was the same. The government also tried to say basically it was some sort of illegal form of healthcare, and since Congress is able to regulate healthcare, it can regulate this kind of law as well. And again, the judge basically said that I don't think that this applies to this either. The final one that the judge was looking at, dealing specifically with the Commerce Clause, was the link between the regulated activity and the interstate commerce, and whether there is a rational basis for finding that the female genital mutilation has a substantial effect on interstate commerce. So basically, the judge applied that rational basis test like we had talked about, and the judge basically said the government's arguments amounts to this. There's a market for, I'm just going to say FGM because that's what they refer to it as.
Right.
There's a market for FGM, and even if defendant's activities have only a slight effect on that market, Congress can regulate it just as in Wickard, Reich, and Chambers. Those are some different Commerce Clause type cases that dealt, I believe, with marijuana, pornography, and things like that. That is, the government seems to concede that it cannot show that the defendants, by performing FGM and or aiding and abetting and or conspiring to do so, had a substantial effect on interstate commerce. But the argument continues, because Congress can regulate the market for this service, it can also regulate the defendants' activities in that market, regardless of how trivial their impact individually may be on the market as a whole. The judge basically said, for the reasons stated above, the court rejects this argument. There is no evidence that FGM is a commercial activity, and there is no evidence that anyone beyond the mothers of these 9 girls alleged in the 3rd superseding indictment is in the market for this service. The one interesting kind of, I guess you might say, Hail Mary kind of argument that the government threw up, the federal government, is that only a federal statute can deal with FGM because, as Congress asserted in its 4th finding, the unique circumstances surrounding the practice of FGM place it beyond the ability of any single state or local jurisdiction to control. And the court basically said this fails for two reasons. First, the Commerce Clause allows Congress to regulate commercial activity that has a substantial effect on interstate commerce, not activity that is, quote-unquote, beyond the ability of any state or local jurisdiction to control. Second, the government informs the court that 27 states have passed FGM statutes, and nothing prevents the others from doing so. So, the judge went on to say there. The judge kind of goes through this and says, and it's almost like the judge is kind of almost apologizing for this ruling, but really trying to make a strict interpretation of it. Basically says, the enactment of the FGM statute was not a permissible exercise of congressional power under the Commerce Clause. That clause permits Congress to regulate activity that is commercial or economic in nature and that substantially affects interstate commerce either directly or as part of the interstate market that has such an effect. The government has not shown either prong is met. There is nothing commercial or economic about FGM. As despicable as this practice may be, it is essentially just a criminal assault, just like the rape at issue in Morrison. Morrison was another Commerce Clause type case where there was a federal statute regarding a rape issue. And says, nor has the government shown that FGM itself has any effect on interstate commerce or that a market exists for FGM beyond the mothers of these nine victims in the indictment. In short, there is no rational basis to conclude that FGM has any effect, to say nothing of a substantial effect, on interstate commerce. The present case cannot be distinguished from Lopez or Morrison. So basically, the judge is trying to say that this is very comparable to the Lopez case, the gun-free school zone we talked about, whereas it's a noble thing for the court, for the Congress to want to do, and it's probably a good idea, but basically this is something that is overstepping the bounds of what Congress has the power to do. This really kind of is an interesting case because you have something that everybody can kind of agree on shouldn't be done, needs to be regulated.
Despicable. Yeah. It's an assault. You're ruining girls, and most of it are done on girls between the ages of 2 and 15.
Yeah.
So you're talking about minors that have no say-so in it.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's one of those things like,
well, can't each state just go ahead and act their own law that says that this is banned?
Well, they really should. And I think that that's one thing that needs to...
There's some states that already have it, don't
there? There are. There are 27 that do.
Okay.
But, you know, the rest of them don't.
Well, so, the rest of them need to get it.
I agree. And this is one of those kind of cases where you look at it and say, well, the traditional struggle between states' right and federal power, should the federal government be able to have the power to do this? And, you know, according to a strict constructionalist or a federalist type person who believes in more in state rights and less in federal rights, their answer is going to be no.
Well, my other question is, why couldn't you just come right out and say it's an assault? It's assault and battery. It'd say you don't name me any other thing that you can do to mutilate somebody that's okay. You do it against their will.
Yeah, but essentially, if you're looking at that, it's still going to be a state-by-state crime. It's not going to be a federal crime.
Well, all right.
That's the problem. You know, it's a state type issue.
Well, it's a hate crime. You hate healthy women.
Well, I don't know. I mean, there's different ways Congress could write this, I think, to try to establish it. But basically the way the law was written, and when it was written, you got to think this was like about the same time that Lopez came out, where basically Congress thought they could put anything under the Commerce Clause and it would stick.
Well, I understand them taking it out from under there, but I think it's one of those things where, what did you say your minimum standard was for something on the
rational basis test?
Yeah, rational basis.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, all right, somebody give me an argument why this is okay and we'll listen to it. Otherwise, I don't care. We're just going to ban it.
Yeah, but the thing is you got to have some sort of source for the power to ban something like that, I think. And I think as written, I think that, you know, as much as I hate to say it, I think maybe the judge got it right that it doesn't fit under the Commerce Clause. And I think that's Congress's fault for not writing it better, essentially.
Well, maybe so, but I think I'd say, I don't care if it's right or not, you're not going to do it.
No, and I'm with you about it. I think, you know, the quickest way to do it is essentially having states enact these different things.
It says, in some cultures, FGM is used to initiate girls into adulthood and to ensure their marriageability.
Yeah.
So it says that the World Health Organization estimates that more than 140 million girls and women globally have undergone this procedure. And more than 3 million girls in Africa alone are at risk of undergoing this procedure every year.
Yeah, there's a growing concern that that this is going to become a bigger problem in the United States as well.
Some of the common justifications of those that practice this is that it's rooted in local culture and that the tradition has been passed from one generation to another.
Right.
Well, that doesn't make it right, you know?
No, it doesn't.
And culture and preservation of cultural identity serve as the underlying impetus for continuing the practice.
Yeah, and none of those actually fly as reasons to commit a crime like this, because if you think about it, there's different religious protections that are crimes as well, like polygamy, things like that. Polygamy is not allowed.
Right. Well, it'd be like, you know, well, look, my dad beat me, so I'm beating my kids.
Yeah.
It's our tradition. That's our culture. We're rednecks. That's what we do.
See, I think the real thing here, and Justice Scalia, who I disagreed with on quite a few things, basically said that in a different case, Congress is only one treaty away from acquiring a general police power. And that's really one of the things that you want to safeguard against, is you don't want to give Congress a blank check to basically regulate everything. And that's why, you know, I think that even though this kind of is one of those cases you really can't get behind and cheer for, that maybe it was right. But I still don't like it.
Well, here's one of the things, too. It basically goes back to the days when women were considered more like property rather than equals.
Yeah.
I mean, you're making these decisions and you're saying, well, in many cases, it's closely linked to the strict expectations regarding women's sexual purity and their lack of desire. In some societies, a prevailing myth is that girls' sexual desires must be controlled early to preserve their virginity and prevent immorality. And in other countries, FGM is seen as necessary to ensure marital fidelity and to prevent deviant sexual behavior. Well, so we take all this out on the woman and make her responsible for all that.
Yeah.
And we decide that this is what she's going to have to go through. But and a lot of people fall back and they say that it's a religious practice. But while it is practiced as under the guise of being religious, it's practiced in adherence of Muslim, Christian, and Jewish faiths. It's also, though, these practices are not compulsory. Because of this flawed link to various religions, and specifically to Islam, religious leaders have an important role to play in disassociating FGM from religion. For example, while FGM is practiced in Egypt, which is predominantly Muslim, it is not practiced in any other countries with predominantly Muslim populations, such as Saudi Arabia and Pakistan. The association with FGM with Islam has been refuted by many Muslim scholars and theologians who say that FGM is not prescribed in the Quran and is contradictory to the teachings of Islam.
Yeah, so it's not really a religious thing so much. It's more of a cultural type thing.
No, it's like it got misconstrued somewhere along the line. And some groups of certain religions adopted this as a practice, saying this will help. But it's not like a protected religious practice. These people just decided to start doing that.
Well, even if it was, it still would not be allowed. You can't even fall back on that argument. You couldn't come back and say that we have a special religion and this is part of our religious procedures, which, you know, you can't do it.
But it's not just like you're doing something that is, you know, it's just going to be done and, oh, well, now there's no, you know, there's, it takes away a certain amount of the, you know, feeling that's involved in it. It said that the physical health implications may include severe bleeding or hemorrhaging, shock from the pain associated with the procedure, risk of infections, especially when unsterile cutting instruments are used or if they are used on several girls at once, urinary retention. Long-term complications include anemia, cysts, scarring, difficulty passing urine, menstrual disorders, recurrent urinary tract infections, fistulas, prolonged labor, and infertility. More recent research shows that women who have experienced any type of FGM run a greater risk of complications during childbirth. Pregnant women can carry a greater risk of needing a cesarean section or an episiotomy and may experience postpartum hemorrhage.
Well, maybe you can make the argument, therefore, that with all these increased medical expenses, that is somewhat related to interstate commerce.
Yeah, they say a lot of girls even display PTSD symptoms after having gone through that because, it's an excruciatingly painful thing. Evidently, there's no anesthesia or something like that. It's just done.
Yeah. That might be a legitimate argument. I didn't see where in the opinion where they tried to argue any kind of that the medical expenses might be somewhat related to it.
Mm-hmm.
It might be a bit of still again. I think that's a bit of a strain, though. I don't think it quite meets the Commerce Clause definition. But
well, we need to develop a strong state policy. Then, if there's nothing else that we can do as a federal government, because I don't see the difference in that between first of all, it's child abuse. There was an episode on The Good Doctor here just a couple weeks ago where a girl came in with complications where her mother had made her go through this procedure and that she was having problems because of it. And she came in, and so they wanted to repair the damage, and the parents were like, no, we want it left that way.
So really?
That was, you know, it's like, okay, you can fix the emergency medical problem, but you're not going to improve the rest of the area there.
So one of the concerns that a lot of articles about this case have had is that basically it will be misconstrued as a win for people who support FGM, which is really not at all what is intended from this ruling. But still, they're going to probably use that to argue that, see, it's not against the law.
Well, first of all, I think the first thing would be is there's going to be a whole lot of people that will say, well, yeah, that goes on in other countries, but they don't do it here. Well, apparently they do.
Yeah.
I mean, I would have thought... I don't know. I wouldn't have thought that went on here, but apparently, you know, if groups that practice that move here, and then they would carry their practices with them. So yeah, that's, of course it's here, but we obviously, if you're not in one of the states that already bans it, then you need to push for legislation to make it banned.
Yeah, absolutely.
Cover the loophole.
That's one thing. That's the quickest way to do this is that every state should have some sort of law in the books that makes this a criminal offense.
There is nothing, there is absolutely no health benefit from doing this. There's no one can make the argument that it improves this or makes that better. It does nothing. It is strictly an outdated way of looking at women and controlling their sexuality and making them part of a man's property.
I read several different articles and opinion pieces where basically people were blasting this judge for ruling this way, basically saying that the judge was just out of his mind to do this and that and the other. But I mean, I think if you look at it from a legal analysis point of view, it's really not that misguided. Now, you might say that where he came down on the opinion, his application of the law in this case, whether or not there were substantial ties and things like that, might be off. But I mean, I don't think it's crazy the way he wrote the opinion. It's not like he just thumbed his nose at it and just said, well, I don't think it should be a crime to begin with. I mean, he basically went through and did a very thorough legal analysis.
And he said it's a despicable act that has no place.
Abhorrent is what he said.
So, I mean, it's not like he thinks it's okay. He just thinks that it was just ruled wrong. But I would not strike it down until everyone has had time to put something in place to cover it is kind of what I would do, I think, if I were him.
Yeah.
But hopefully someone will file for an injunction and carry it on further or something anyway.
Well, the federal government is going to appeal it, they said, or they're looking at whether or not they're going to appeal it or not. The other thing is, too, is that they are charged still with different charges. Like there's a conspiracy charge and something else. So that if they're convicted, they both could be sentenced up to 20 years in prison. That's for the doctors. Now, the parents, they were basically dismissed from the case based upon these.
See, if they allowed it to be done, they should be held responsible too. And not only do they need to make it illegal, they need to impose really strict penalties because, you know, a lot of these people, if they're hiding behind religion, they're going to say, well, I'll pay the fine or whatever, if that's what it is to do it because it's worth it, because that's what it says that we're supposed to do.
Yeah.
So they need to make the penalties severe so that there aren't any repeat offenders.
It's funny, too. There's a lot of different politicians out there. One Michigan state senator said, I'm angry that the federal judge dismissed this horrific case that affected upwards of 100 girls who were brutally victimized and attacked against their will. This is why it was important for Michigan to act. We set a precedent that female genital mutilation will not be tolerated here, and we did so by passing a state law that comes with a 15-year felony punishment. I hope other states will follow suit. So, you know, I think other states should follow suit, and they should pass state laws which outlaw this. So,
absolutely.
But again, this is one of those cases that, I mean, it just does. You just don't feel happy about because it's like, well, it's a hard time to kind of justify it.
Well, you know, if it was women making the rules instead of men, and they wanted to control a sexuality or immorality problem, there might be some Lorena Bobbitt type activities going on out there instead of this type of thing, you know. And so think about it with the shoe on the other foot. How would you feel about that?
I'm not really following what you're saying there.
I'm saying that it's a male dominated practice.
Oh, it is. Yeah,
puts these things in place. That if females were in charge, maybe it'd be the other way around, and they'd be clipping something else. And then maybe guys would be jumping up and down and saying, hey, this isn't right. We got to do something about it.
I don't know. I mean, I feel pretty much indignant about it regardless of whichever the shoe's on whatever foot. I mean, I just, I'm thinking about more from an application.
You don't put a shoe on it.
I'm thinking more about an application from a federal law type point of view, not necessarily who the powers are that are enacting it or who's trying to do this, because I don't think that really falls into the analysis. I think I'm looking at it strictly from a constitutional analysis point of view.
Well, I'm just looking at it from a outraged citizen point of view, and this needs to be brought to the social consciousness, and it needs to be enacted upon at the state level as quickly as possible anywhere that it's not, and the penalties need to be severe.
Hear, hear. I agree.
We'll have who was he? Josephus.
Yeah.
Jehoshaphat. We'll have Jehoshaphat go argue that for us. Yeah. He'll get it done.
Jehoshaphat would definitely get it done.
That's right.
He would be very angry about it. Very disdainful in a very tasteful southern manner.
I say unto you, my fellow legislators, we must enact this to end this abhorrent procedure.
I knew you were going to say abhorrent. I could see the writing on the wall. Well, I think that's going to bring us to
Legal Briefs.
So Legal Briefs is the part of the show where we talk about different legal terms, see if Tommy can answer what they are. That last part of the show is a bit of a bummer part of a show because it's such a serious topic. So
yeah, it's hard to joke about that. There's nothing to joke about.
Yeah, you can't joke about it. But it is I think it is a very important thing to be aware of and try to understand the reason why, because a lot of the news articles you'll see about it will be very inflammatory and try to say that, you know, basically it was struck down for no reason or things like that. But I think it is important to understand that there was actually a legitimate legal basis as to why it was struck down, which, you know, may or may not be the right decision. But all right. So the first legal brief is rational basis review.
Well, that was one that you just look at it and kind of give it the sniff test. Does it seem rational? And you say, yeah, that's the lowest level.
It is the lowest level. So you got that right. Sniff test is nowhere to be found. It's basically tests whether the government's actions are rationally related to a legitimate government interest.
Right.
So, and it's the lowest level, like you said, and it's for generally federal laws that don't involve any kind of heightened scrutiny where there's a suspect class or a fundamental right. When that's attacked. Speaking of which, driving, that's a fundamental right, right?
No. It is a privilege.
That's right.
Just like voting.
It was a trick question. No. Voting, I believe, is a fundamental right.
Oh, a privilege.
And a privilege. It's two for one.
That's right. That's why they do it on Tuesdays. It's a two for Tuesday. That's why it's always, that's when you vote on.
What is the Commerce Clause?
Well, he's the guy that handles all the money at the North Pole. And it is a law that was enacted that basically says that anything that affects interstate commerce in the United States can be enacted upon by the federal government.
That sounded very circleful.
Now I'm the pivot man.
What? He said that Congress enacted this. How was it enacted?
Well, they made it be. They voted on it and made it be.
In what document?
It was the Constitution.
That's right. It's a constitutional article.
It's only got like 16 words.
That's right.
And it says, if it moves and has intercourse, we're going to put laws about it.
we're gonna regulate that. I'll know it when I see it. Now, what was the one case that reined in the Commerce Clause?
That was like Zippo v. Harvey or something. I don't know.
Zippo v. Harvey.
Yeah, something like that.
Where in the world did that come from?
The recesses of my mind.
It was a U.S. v. Lopez.
Yeah.
And what did that case...
Zippo Lopez, that's about the same.
What did that case involve?
That involved was that the one with the steamboats?
No.
Oh.
That was Gibbons v. Ogden.
Oh, well, that must have been a different one then that it involved.
U.S. v. Lopez. U.S. v. Lopez is the gun-free school zone case.
Yeah, that one. That's it. And so they want you bringing guns to school to shoot other kids.
No. That's not what the opinion said.
They struck it down.
They basically said it's not related to interstate commerce, essentially, having guns in schools.
Yeah, they said that.
All right, now here's the bonus question.
Oh, no. I hadn't got the regular ones.
I know. Maybe you'll get the bonus. It'll make it all better. Who was the Supreme Court justice that weighed in on the U.S. v. Lopez case, which reined in the Commerce Clause?
Rehnquist.
That's right.
Well, what do you know about that?
Yeah, I think that gives you a passing score.
I'm glad it wasn't anybody else, because that was the only name I remembered.
Well, it's a good job.
Other than John Marshall, I knew that one, but that was a little bit after him.
After?
Yeah.
No, Marshall was before him.
Well, I meant Rehnquist was a little bit after John Marshall.
Oh, okay. You're trying to confuse me here.
That's my normal way of operating. That's my operatus modus operandi or something like that. Confusing.
That's my operandi modus.
If you can't dazzle them with brilliance, you baffle them with bullshit.
You're very good at that. Thanks to everybody for listening, and thanks to MCRB for use of their song, Doctor, Lawyer, Indian Chief.
And thanks to the McElroy Stable of Podcasts for the use of their recording studio. Their podcasts include Mabim Bam, Sawbones, and Still Buffering, as well as many other fine offerings. And please, take the time to rate and review us on iTunes, especially if you liked us. If you didn't, well, then not so much.
You're not supposed to say that.
You always edit that out, though, right?
Usually. Good. This has been Court Appointed. I'm Mike Meadows, your co-host. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurf, and I'm just a dude.
Thanks for listening.